You're listening to the Mako Minute, the 482nd Fighter Wing Podcast. You're going to hear what it's like to work for the president, how to stay resilient, and what happens when a service member passes away downrange. Right now, we're headed over to Custer's Corner.
Hi, Makos. I'm incredibly excited to kick things off with this inaugural edition of Custer's Corner. We had a fantastic response to our call for podcast names, and after reviewing a ton of creative submissions from across the wing, as you've already heard, Mako Minute emerged as a clear winner. Huge thanks to everyone who contributed. You'll be hearing from your supervisor soon about some well-deserved time off. Let's dive into what's happening around the wing. Chief Allen has officially transitioned to his new role as NAF Command Chief at 10th Air Force. Seeing his office empty today really drove home how much his mentorship has meant to me and the entire wing. We're certainly going to miss having him here daily, but the good news is we haven't lost him completely. He'll still be keeping an eye on us from the NAF. And even better news, Chief Miller will be holding down the fort until Chief Kerry Contreras arrives in June, ensuring continued leadership and support for each and every one of you. The wing is continuing to support Secretary of State Rubio's almost weekly movements. We're handling President Trump's overflow support when he is in Florida. We've hosted Month of the Military Child this month, had a great Family Day and Car Show a few months ago, and countless other events showcasing the dedication and professionalism of Homestead. As we continue our day-to-day, please remember, members of the 70th Airport Squadron are now deployed, and I ask you to keep them and their families in your thoughts and prayers. Next up, I want to express immense pride in this wing and how you handle numerous unforeseen challenges and to make our TDY to NEO Host 25 in Greece a resounding success. Any doubts about the Mako's ability to adapt and overcome have been definitely put to rest. In short, we flew 180 sorties, 128 of which were exercise-related, totaling nearly 500 flight hours. We participated in all 27 vols and integrated with 14 partner nations across air, sea, and land domains. Most importantly, our team significantly enhanced proficiency across multiple mission sets, crucial as we prepare to become AFRIC's first deployable combat wing, a unit of action. This experience is invaluable as we move forward. An important update on our transition to a deployable combat wing. The initial plan involves splitting the 42nd into separate fighter wing and airbase units. As many of you know, recent changes mean we'll remain a unified fighter wing and instead create a DCW unit type code. This UTC will function very similarly to what the separate fighter wing was intended to be. What does this mean for you? For the vast majority, it means business as usual. Keep focusing on faith, family, and mission. Within your mission, I need you to be experts in your AFSC and proactively communicate any challenges hindering your progress to your leadership. Equally important is respecting those around you completely and upholding the standard in everything you do. Over the next few months, you'll see us assigning personnel to A-staff positions. Initially, this will be a secondary duty, but it will eventually become a primary role during UTAs, exercises, and our planned deployment for 27-1. We will also be designating specific AFSCs and individuals to form a combat airbase squadron, or CABS, under a CABS commander for the deployment. We'll be putting these new structures to the test in a major force exercise the first week of November. The plan is to deploy command and control and CABS to Dobbins Air Reserve Base, while Maintenance Operations and Mission Support Team, or MGFE and MSTs, will forward deploy to a separate location. This will allow us to practice enacting commander's intent and responding to simulated wartime scenarios. This November exercise will be a crucial practice run for at least 50% of the UTC, setting the stage for our capstone certification in March. This certification is expected to take place at Nellis Air Force Base during a red flag exercise for the MGFE, with command and control and CABS deploying to a location yet to be determined. We have a lot of work ahead to solidify these processes, but if our performance at NEO Host is any indication, I'm confident in our ability to succeed. I have complete faith in the Makos, and I need your input, expertise, and commitment to make this happen. Seeing the tactical execution of our mission and how it contributes to our nation's strategic objectives is incredibly inspiring. The Makos are setting the standard for effort, and I know the Mako standard will continue to impress. Thanks again for all you do. Please send any questions up the chain of command, and I'll do my best to answer each one. Custer out.
So how you doing, sir?
Good.
Yeah, so let's do the painful part and just go ahead and introduce yourself.
Senior Master Sergeant Thomas Kelly, from the 42nd Force Sports Squadron.
And what do you do here at the 42nd here at Homestead?
So I'm the section flight chief for the sustainment side. And basically, day-to-day operations here mostly include lodging, that I manage that program and the fitness for the base, entering the scores and helping people get through some of their issues with lodging and fitness issues.
So, like, first let's talk about lodging.
Okay.
So how many people, how many reservists come down here and need lodging?
We average between like 400 to 600 every UTA, just depending on.
So 400 to 600 people a month?
A month.
Need to have lodging here?
Yes.
That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. We contract with about 15 hotels to accommodate everybody.
How do you do that though?
We have the ALRS system, which basically puts that in the palm of their hand with their phone. So if it's just a UTA, they can go in like any other app and just kind of like you're booking a hotel on any other platform, and you just select what dates and it's easy. Where it gets kind of cloudy is when they have to do reschedules or they're throwing some annual tour in there and they want having a conjunction. So then that kind of gets me involved.
That's when you have to step in.
And everybody's situation's a little different. You know, some people are Thursday, Friday, some are Friday, Monday, some are Monday, Tuesday. So it's every reservation is different. It's all the same, but it's all different.
For anywhere between 400 to 600 people.
Yes. A month. So probably about 80% of those self-book, and it's pretty easy. And then the other 20 are just reschedules or senior leadership coming in early, staying late.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. That sounds like a challenge.
It's tedious. It's a lot of computer work. It's a lot of just going in and managing the program through the app. And I have a computer app that I use. It helps me manage everything, and everybody else just uses their phone.
Right, right. Okay. You're so nonchalant about it.
I think I've gotten used to it. It was a little timid at first, a little scary at first. And then I got like fuel to the fire, because I think the first UTA I did it, when we switched over, it was like a 4-day. So I got really inundated with it really rapidly. And we had another unit here. And one of their tech sergeants was their ALRS person up there. So she kind of sat behind me that weekend and just over my shoulder showed me how to do everything. And believe me, that was a godsend, because had she not been here, it would have been a lot worse.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I hate finding a hotel room for myself. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine trying to do it for that many other people. So one of the other things I see you do here a lot that you hadn't mentioned is that, I mean, you guys feed people.
We do.
How many people, like on a typical drill weekend, how many people do you feed?
Normally breakfast is a little less, but we're averaging about 250 per meal period.
250 per meal period? Mm-hmm.
So Saturday we do breakfast and lunch with a box dinner, just because we didn't have such a big need for it at dinner time. So we reduced that down to just a box meal, and then breakfast, lunch on Sunday. So we're doing 4 meal periods every UTA with about, like I said, between 200, 250.
And you have to manage, and part of your job is to manage all the people that are doing that feeding.
Yeah, we have a master sergeant that's in charge of that section. And then myself and Senior Leon kind of manage the unit during the UTA. But that master sergeant basically oversees the food section as far as the shifts, the hours, any issues that come up.
Right.
Training.
And I've seen you in the chow line myself. Like, so, I mean, you know firsthand what it's like. And one of the things I'm curious about, because before I came over here to interview, I was kind of had my own reflection about some of the things I do involving services around here in the base. And I thought about it and I was like, well, you know, I mean, I go to chow in the morning and I walk in there at 6:30 in the morning, and all I'm thinking about is what I want to eat. And I'm not thinking about that guy or that girl, that airman behind that hot kitchen making it. What time does that person show up?
So they're probably waking up at 4:04 to get dressed, grab some food for themselves if they're, you know, hungry, and getting here by 5:00, and it's literally stepping on an ant pile.
Really?
At 5:00, they're all back there, hands on, ovens are on, you know, eggs are down, bacon's in, depending on whatever else they're preparing, hash browns, things like that, the fryers. So it's really just a quick hour to get everything up on the line, ready to go by 6:00.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, we talk about the chow line. That's always what you see, like, in the movies and stuff, right? Is like, you know, a big, massive chow line, people going through, they're slopping the eggs on the plate and stuff like that, you know, and then you kind of go about your day. But I've had times where I've come in here for breakfast, and I think I've seen you in the chow hall area doing something food-related during breakfast, and then I went through my entire day, and then I had to attend an event that night, and you were there, and all the other staff were there, and everybody was wearing white jackets at that point.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a long day.
Yeah. Typically, I'm here on UT weekends around 5:30, and that's just to make sure everybody got here on time.
Mm-hmm.
Any incidents happen, to kind of address those quickly. And then, like you said, if we have an after hours event, I'm either attending it or I've worked them a majority of the time previous to being a flight chief, would be like the head master sergeant or senior master sergeant there. But yeah, a lot of UTAs for me, minimum is 10 to 12 hours every day.
Okay.
On a UTA. And that's just to be here for the people, just to make sure things run smoothly, just to be there for top cover in case anybody needs something.
Does that seem like a little bit, and I hope you don't take this out of context the way I ask it here, because one of the things that when I learned broadcasting in the Air Force, one of the units that they would talk about that was services, and they had a particular way that they would describe services. They said that services is the redheaded stepchild of the Air Force. And they would say that because by saying that, you guys don't get enough credit for what you do. And you've been doing this for a long time. So you got to have, I mean, I would imagine you got to have some sort of way to recognize, to have self-fulfillment for your job, to be able to show up here and do this day in, day out. I mean, what do you do so that, what is there anything you see, or like, how do you keep going?
So think about a UTA if you showed up and you didn't have food, and think about a UTA if you showed up and didn't have a place to stay. How difficult your UTA would be if you had to feed yourself, which everybody could, right? They could go out and buy food, but it's timely. And then if you had to find your own lodging and pay for your own lodging, what a, you know, mess that is going through DTS every single UTA. So I basically, when I talked to the troops, I remember one of the officers that was retiring put one of the flag staffs down, and he said, you know, at the end of the day, there's a spear on the end of this. And if you think of the planes that are flying and providing the mission that they do, dropping bombs or reconnaissance or intel, whatever they're doing, and then you look at the other end of the pole, which basically is the end that doesn't do any damage, everybody has a job in the middle. And if you take one piece out of that pole, it's not as effective as it's one single unit. So I tell people, you're effective, right? You might not be dropping a bomb, or you might not be flying a plane, or you might not be carrying a gun, but you're just as important because you're feeding all the people and you're housing all the people. You're keeping the people fit, doing the fitness side. So I said, you know, our job is important. You might not be on the front line and getting all the glory, but people would be a lot more miserable without food and a place to sleep.
Right. You know, and that actually brings me to another point, is that you guys just don't feed people in the chow hall. I mean, like, what are some of the other environments that you guys had that I keep saying you guys, but the force support squadron services, what are some of the other environments that you have to be prepared to feed people in?
Yeah. Any environment that you have airmen downrange,
anywhere.
So whether it's deployed, whether it's a field kitchen, you know, set up hastily, whether we're just transporting MREs and making sure that they're safe and, you know, given out, and, you know, everything's accountable also, right? Everything's an asset. So it has to be secured. It has to be accounted for. So even if we have just one services member handing out 500 MREs, or we have a team of say 10, you know, airmen NCOs out there cooking in a spec kitchen, we have to be able to feed wherever the airmen are, right? Because that's, they're providing their duties. They're fueling planes, arming planes, flying planes, things like that. So you got to be able to feed, make sure everybody's got their energy and good to go for the fight.
Yeah. And I would encourage that if you're listening to this, you should go to the Homestead ARB Facebook page, because we have posted pictures of Senior Kelly training people in some of the interesting ways that you have prepared food. And I think the last one I took pictures of you at, we were just in a field. We were just in a field, and you guys had set up a generator and a way to just make food hot. And I got to tell you, that, I mean, having a hot meal, it does make you feel better.
Yeah, it's the whole multi-capable airman is we were wanting during the last exercise to just show everybody that was involved in the exercise if services got taken out, right? Whether we didn't show up, the plane didn't arrive, you had the pieces here, you had the food here, how could you heat it? Because if you didn't know how to turn it on, you didn't know how to submerge it, you didn't know to keep things locked, there's dangers opposed or dangers that are with it, with the steam that comes out of the apparatus that cooks it. So just giving a quick 30-minute class on here's how you drop it, here's how you secure it, here's how you open it, here's how you use it, was basically just, a quick field kitchen. Even if you didn't have the tent set up, you could still cook food. As long as you had that generator and you had that tray ration heater, you have two pieces of equipment, you can eat.
Yeah, hot food. Mm-hmm.
Hot food.
Yeah, mm-hmm. which I is a... That's a motivator,
right.
I think.
Absolutely.
So how long have you been? Have you always been in the Air Force?
Always Air Force. Actually came in a long time ago, 1987 was my initial go on to basic training date. Was in for 10 years as security forces, security police back then. Did 5 bases, ended up at Andrews as my last duty station and was flying with presidential unit. Got a little tired of kind of packing my bags every week and leaving and got out. Was out for about 11 years and came back in the reserves. And then when I came back, they said, your hearing's not so good. You can't be a security police anymore. And they gave me about 6 job opportunities. And the recruiter at the time said, one of my friends is in services. And he said, it's a good job. There's a lot of different little job aspects that you could do. And she said, if you're looking for something that's kind of got a lot of options, that's a good one. So I looked at all the choices and I said, let's do services. So I got here and loved it ever since.
So I had talked to some people before I came here to interview you and I had multiple people say, and that's why I went in your office to go look at some pictures. They said, ask him about the picture with the president. So tell me a little bit about that. So you traveled with the president?
So about President Clinton from about 95 to 97, when I was at Andrews, they had positions open to be the armed security for the plane. So you're an aircraft security NCO or airman, and you're armed, right? Mm-hmm. You have a Beretta, and you're basically ensuring that plane is secure, safe, 24/7 security wherever it went. You were manifesting people, checking bags, making sure fuel went on the plane, and that you would basically watch every person. Everything they did, if they were touching that plane, you were watching them to make sure they weren't planting something on the plane, bringing something on the plane that shouldn't be there. We flew with the Secret Service. We flew with, National Security Agency, everybody else that flew with the president. We were always there. And on the plane, we would kind of sit in the back and you were kind of relaxing then. But as soon as you hit the ground, you were starting a shift. So if you flew for 8-10 hours, as soon as you landed, somebody has that first shift like 4 to 8 hours. And then the other people with you would then pick up the shifts throughout. And you basically sit in the car or you sit in a station right outside the plane and guard that plane until the crew arrives and you take off to go to the next one. But I did that for about 2 years, went to about 40 countries. 40 in 2 years. So that's what I mean. We were traveling a lot.
40 in 2 years. That is a lot.
That is a lot.
I mean, join the Air Force and see the world, right?
Right. I've seen a lot for free. I had a lot of good memories, a lot of good pictures back in the day.
Yeah. What are some of the fun memories?
We took the first lady, Hillary Clinton, to Africa, and that was just about 8 stops in Africa, everywhere from South Africa to Zimbabwe to Eritrea. We went to Victoria Falls. We actually went out. She was staying somewhere for a couple of days, so we had a day that we actually went out on a safari.
Oh, really?
And got to go in Tanzania National Park and see all that, and then some of the other memorable trips were Vietnam. I remember we landed in Hanoi and Saigon and you could still see some of the bomb craters from the Vietnam War when you're flying over. Went to Russia, went to some very remote locations in Russia where they had probably not seen Americans before and they were just, they'd see the way we dress and they would just stop on the street and stare at us like we were aliens walking through the neighborhood. Just had a lot of good opportunities and just a lot of amazing places that I got to go see.
What would be your favorite place and not just your time when you were on a presidential detail or anything, but favorite place TDY or deployment that you've ever been to?
I remember Tel Aviv was one of the places that I just was always like, man, I hope I get to come back here sometime.
And really?
Just the people were very friendly. The location was awesome. It was right there, I believe, on the Red Sea. Mm-hmm. It was just an interesting place and culturally just someplace I always said, if I get time, I want to go back. I did live in Germany for a couple of years when I was overseas on a long tour. And I loved that region too, just being able to drive and kind of be able to hit so many different countries within a mm-hmm. couple of days. And the Mosel River with all the wine country down there was amazing to go and stay and visit. So I think Germany and kind of Tel Aviv were probably my two favorite places.
Okay. What about the worst? What place do you never want to see again?
The worst. Probably the scariest was when we were in Vietnam. We were in Hanoi, and I was working the midnight shift. And unbeknownst to me, they didn't let me know. They shut all the power off to the entire airport.
Oh.
At like, I don't know, midnight or 1 a.m. I guess they had no more flights coming in. So I guess they're saving money as they just basically hit a circuit breaker and every light at that airport turns off.
Oh.
So you can imagine being out there on a well-lit tarmac and then all of a sudden everything goes to where you can't see your hand in front of your face.
Yeah.
Very scary. I was by myself. Who knows how long until backup would get there if I did call for somebody. So I remember I grabbed like four more magazines from there. Plane up and where we hold our ammunition.
By magazines, you don't mean something that you're going to read.
No, the 9mm magazines. And I stuck those in my waistband and I grabbed another Beretta. And I'm like, well, if something happens, I got two guns and about eight magazines.
Wow.
And I'll go out with a fight. So.
Wow. Wow. That's wild.
Yeah. It was just probably the scariest time I was ever.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and you grew up in a time where Vietnam, there were some connotations about Vietnam, I'm sure, from your childhood. It was
an eerie place to go through. We were walking through Hanoi, and there was a museum, and we went in there. And you know how you go to, like, a museum here, and you see, like, relics of World War II, things like that? Well, they had relics of American.
Oh.
So you're looking at all the American stuff they, not I don't say captured, but got from the war. So you're looking at all American uniforms and equipment, helicopter pieces and
ooh,
pictures that they had. So it was kind of eerie being in a
kind of
another country where they, you know, they had the Americans,
yeah,
valuables and war relics there.
Yeah. I remember that. I've only had one experience like that, and it was not, any place like Vietnam. I was in England.
Okay.
And I was in a museum in England, and, it was like a military section, and there was this huge timeline of all the conflicts that the British military had been in and the American Revolution, which and here in America is like the biggest thing that ever happened. Right. But the American Revolution over there on this timeline, it was like a one sentence blip. And then it moved. I was like, wow. Like the different perspective.
Yeah. You realize when you go, I think, to other countries and overseas, just how old, right, the world is. Like we get mm-hmm. here and we're like, oh, Liberty Bell and things like that. Like there were so many things going on before then mm-hmm. that all these countries have documented, and we kind of don't realize it until you like go into one of their museums and you say, oh wow, like there was a lot going on before
right.
America was fighting a battle.
Yeah. Would you say, would that be a piece of advice that you would want to give to young airmen or people who are just coming in? Like if you go someplace, like Go find the history.
Yeah. Like when I was in Germany, it was really before cell phone age and a lot of technology computers. So you hung around with friends and you went and you traveled and you hung out with a lot of the local people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be my biggest thing is if you go, like get out and meet some of the people in your community, the area you're at, because they'll take you to some of these places and show you some of these things because they were taught that as kids.
Right.
As opposed to sitting in your dorm or you know, just hanging on base, like get out and explore.
It's
a lot to see.
Yeah. Go find something. Mm-hmm. Right. So a little bit more about you as a person, because, the funny thing is that I'm a traditional reservist. So when I come down here, you know, you probably look at me and you're like, oh yeah, Paul's back or Cook's back, you know, for the 1 week in a month or my annual tour, I'm here for this week, stuff like that. But every time I come here, you're here.
Yeah.
like, you're always here, you know? Yep. I just saw the expression on your face change. I hope I didn't upset you there.
No, that's not a bad thing. I mean, I chose to be here and, you know, if you're here past 20 years, you like it, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people do their 20 and they're stamping to get out. Mm-hmm. I've chose to stay longer and there hasn't been that bad of a day where I've said I need to get out. So, you know, I did 20 years in law enforcement. I did this for 23 years and I would pick this job again in a heartbeat.
Really?
Just being in the Air Force. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
So what, so when you're here after like a 12-hour day or say you just had one heck of a week, what do you do for fun? What are your personal interests?
Yeah. So I like to go down to the Keys, just find a little place to go eat, grab something to drink. I just bought a boat recently, which
I
love. Yeah. Small boat.
What kind of boat?
Just a little 18-foot, Scout center console, but just something that I can get out on the water.
Yeah.
Instead of relying on friends, you know, to take you out, it's nice just to have your own that you can go. So I want to start doing that a little more this summer and, just traveling a little bit, getting out, music, love listening to music. Little bit of sports here and there, play golf, play volleyball, things like that. So yeah, I just try to stay active. And again, just sitting back after a long day, you know, in the backyard, looking at the palm trees.
Yeah.
Having a nice cold one doesn't hurt either.
Yeah. I think anybody who is listening to this, who's from any other branch just went, of course he plays golf. He's in the Air Force. Andrews Air Force Base when I was up in, I was TDY up in the area and I was working with two guys who were in the Army and we went there and the first thing they did was go, you guys actually do have golf courses? And I was like, yeah, we have golf courses on the base. And they were like, we thought that was a joke. Like,
no, Andrews is nice because you'll be putting on one of the greens and Air Force One will come landing right over the top of it.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Wow. So, If you had any advice for young airmen or young non-commissioned officers where you have already walked some of these paths, right? And somebody came to you and was looking for a mentor. If you could give like a couple nuggets of advice for that person, what would it be?
You know, the biggest thing that held me back in my military career is I always said to myself, oh, I'll get my education. You know, I'll get the GI Bill or I'll go to school. I didn't get my associates until I was probably 52 years old.
Oh.
And that held me back from promoting. That held me back from a few different things. Had I done that in my 20s, right, it would have opened that door, I think, for a few opportunities that I probably missed. So I would tell the younger people, get your at least your associates done as quickly as possible. It's not that hard. I don't know why I sat on it. I think I was just working and traveling and having a family and putting it on the back burner. And then when it finally came to make senior, guess what? You were held to the fire and I had to jump online real quick and take, you know, about 8 classes and finally got that associates. And as soon as I got that associates, yeah, I was eligible to promote, but why did I wait so long? You know, that's the thing. Just if you can get that education done, get it done as soon as you can. Associates is great. If you want to wait to, you know, finish your bachelor's down the road to figure out what you want to major in, that's fine. But an associate will get you at least in the door. Mm-hmm. So get that knocked out within your first 4 or 6 years that you're in.
Okay. Okay. That's, I think that's great advice.
Yeah.
And everybody can tell we're at an Air Force base right now. I think some jets are taking off. So, there is one other thing, of a serious topic here is, what are some tips, for resiliency that you've learned throughout your time, throughout how many years have you been in now?
23.
Yeah. So for 23 years, how do you keep going? Like, what would you tell somebody how to do it?
I mean, I think for those that know me closer, my sense of humor, if it doesn't kill you, just have fun.
Yeah.
Have a joke. Try to just have a good ring of friends that you can depend on and talk to. You know, when Chief LaVille was here and, you know, Senior Leon and I and a couple other, after UTA, you just go sit out back and you just, you know, just talk for 30 minutes and just
let it go.
Get it off your chest. Yeah. Just have somebody to talk to. Exercise is a big thing. You know, I don't think we push it as much as an active duty base does, because mm-hmm. we don't see people for 28 days a month, but
right.
exercise, you know, you got to get out, whether you're just walking a mile or two or practicing for your test, you know, mm-hmm. throughout the month. A lot of exercise is good, and just healthy coping strategies, you know what I mean, to get yourself through.
Right, right. And the most serious question, that I'm going to ask you, and this is weighing on many people's minds. If you had to go on a road trip with three historical figures, who would they be?
How far are we talking about?
Well, that's the next question, is where you're going to go. But first, okay, you know what? Okay, three historical figures. We'll switch it up. Three historical figures. You're going on a road trip to, let's see here, Disney World. You're driving from Homestead to Disney World. Three historical figures. Go. And the clock's. I forgot to tell you, you have a time limit before you have to.
If I'm going to Disney World, I want some funny people in there. So I'd have to pick a comic.
Okay.
I would probably, what was the guy that played in Jumanji?
Oh, Robin Williams.
Robin Williams, yeah. Probably definitely be a great first pick.
That would be like nonstop.
Yeah. And then maybe somebody with a little more, maybe Clint Eastwood in there.
Okay.
Just to have, just to be around him and just pick his brain would be great. Just
okay.
to hear his side of things. And the third one, let's see. That's a tough one. Historical figures. I mean,
it could be any historical figure whatsoever.
Let's go with Queen Elizabeth when she was 25.
Queen Elizabeth when yes. she... That's a
no
good
idea.
One.
No idea. I'm just grabbing here.
Okay. And the last question in that group is who rides shotgun?
Definitely Clint.
Clint.
Yeah, absolutely. Robin will be in the back. Keeping
just the constant queen, soundtrack of jokes.
Keeping the queen entertained.
Well, listen, before I let you go, is there anything you want to add?
I think we went on everything, you know, just part of services is mortuary. And I think we don't realize that because we never really exercise that. We see it.
Wait, back that up a second here, because this is a first for me. So okay. Part of services is mortuary.
Absolutely. So we send people to Port Mortuary, AFMEO, to get training. And if we go somewhere and say a member does pass away or has a combat injury, we will make sure that member is processed right properly.
Yeah.
Dignified.
Yeah.
Just we're gonna make sure that they get put on a plane, make sure that they are taken to a place where they can be transferred back to Port Mortuary. But yeah, one of our jobs is mortuary. So I don't think a lot of people realize that because we don't deal with it in a real life.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, we're serving food. Yeah, we're doing push-up sit-ups, but we're not handling soldiers, right? But that is one of our jobs. And if we do go downrange, we will always have a mortuary tent. We'll have a food tent. We'll have a fitness tent, things like that. But yeah, that's one of our jobs. And
I never knew that.
Yeah. So we're trained. We have teams that will go and get trained in that. And then, you know, it's a procedure. It's identifying. It's getting medical to have the doctor come and declare. It's proper icing procedures, right? It's putting them into an HRP, a human remains pouch, getting them a tail number, getting them processed.
By tail number, you mean?
For the aircraft.
Okay.
Requesting the flight that aircraft out. Comes and say, you know, we have this many people here that need transport to, whether it's Germany or back to Port Mortuary. We're going to request that they get moved as quickly as possible. Like, we don't want them staying there longer than they have to, but we have to know how to ice them properly. Right. We have to put certain things on yeah. certain parts of their body. We have to, if we have belongings and things like that, so you got to know how to process those. The loved ones are going to want their things back. So yeah, it's a whole nother thing that we don't really see a lot of, but we are trained in.
You discussed a lot of the training as to the actual physical things you're going to do, like organizing the plane and the ice and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But like, how do you mentally train somebody for that?
You don't, you know, being in law enforcement, like I said, for 20 something years, everybody handles something like that differently, right? Me and you could see the same exact thing
mm-hmm.
and you could have traumatic stress for the rest of your life, right? Or post-traumatic stress mm-hmm. disorder. I could see it and just process it and be resilient and move on and never have to deal with it again. So everybody handles something differently. And that's what you got to be careful of is, you know, when someone is affected, are they going to be okay? Do we need to remove them from that team? Is it something that they can push through? Do they need to go talk to a mental health person right away? A lot of times it's just, you know, you got to think about people that deal with that all the time in the military. It's a stressful thing to see that time and time again. So yeah, it's something that we would want to watch, and the team leader needs to be talking to the team constantly. You okay? How's it going? How was today? Anything bother you today? So just, yeah, checking on that team, make sure that they're mentally ready.
I'm so glad that you brought that up.
Yeah.
Cause I myself included had no idea.
Yeah. And I mean, we didn't really harp on fitness very much either. But we do, you know, we run anywhere from 80 to 120 people through on most UTA weekends, and a lot of units test themselves. Mm-hmm. But, we're seeing a lot of people make that change to the hammer, which is, I think, a good thing. A lot of people now can.
And the hammer is can you describe the hammer?
20 meter inside, basically.
As opposed to the mile and a half run.
Opposed to six laps outside, you're doing anywhere from 25 to 72 laps, you know, back and forth, almost the length of the basketball court in a time shuttle. So we're seeing a lot of people transition to that.
I myself is one of them, by the way.
Yeah. It's almost now you can almost get through the workout and not even in sweat. You know, here in South Florida, you go outside and run a mile and a half.
Yeah.
You're going to see it. You do.
Well, in August, if you walk across the street, you sweat.
Absolutely. But yeah, just people staying on top of their fitness is important.
Okay.
Just year round.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And we might see some changes. Who knows? You know, I'm sure there's some things in the work with all branches. I think we're getting all their programs looked at. So we might see some changes in the next 6 months or a year.
Well, what is it? Semper Gumby, right? Always flexible.
Always flexible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Senior Kelly, thank you for giving us, a half an hour of your time. I really appreciate it.
It went fast.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That about wraps it up for this episode. If you'd like more content from the 42nd Fighter Wing, be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram. We'll see you next time on the Mako Minute.